From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Mayor John Mitchell on why he's so optimistic about New Bedford's future.
New Bedford has some real strong cards to play, and we're in the business right now of rebuilding a city. It's not just recovering, we're building.
Also today, Mother Teresa is now Saint Teresa of Calcutta, but a former nun says Teresa's life and what she demanded of her followers are more complicated than her popular image might seem.
Mother Teresa used to tell us that even if we were taking care of the babies, not to hold them any longer than was necessary.
And why did she
It was an extreme way that Mother Teresa understood the vow of chastity.
Plus, Randolph native Femita Iyembekwu, she's competing in the Rio Paralympics just 9 months after she learned how to run.
I just feel so free. Running feels so much more natural to me.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and a good Wednesday afternoon to you. We're going to start today on the South Coast. Lots going on there. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation and MBTA are hosting a public meeting about South Coast Rail alternatives tonight, the first of six such meetings. But more immediately, all three offshore wind developers competing to build turbines south of Martha's Vineyard signed a letter of intent yesterday to stage their operations in New Bedford, a major win for the city and a significant step forward in launching the wind energy industry in southeastern Massachusetts. Well, that's where we began when we spoke with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell a little earlier today.
Well, it's good news. It's an affirmative step forward for the offshore wind industry, which has been maturing for some 25 years in Northern Europe and is just now coming to the United States. And its launching pad is going to be New Bedford, Massachusetts. We are the closest industrial port to some of the windiest places on the planet up and down the eastern seaboard. And we're the largest commercial fishing port in the United States, and our people know what they're doing out on the water. So we're ready to go.
I want to talk to you about fishing here in just a second. But you told South Coast Today about offshore wind operations in New Bedford that, quote, there will be others who jump into this game, and we need to outsmart them and out-hustle them. How do you plan to do that?
Well, so New Bedford will likely not be the only port involved in the offshore wind industry in the long run. There are places like Paulsboro, New Jersey, and Quonset, Rhode Island, and others who will want a piece of the action. And I suspect that the industry will be big enough to support more than one port. But, you know, it's incumbent upon us in New Bedford to compete and compete hard. New Bedford's gone through many transitions over the course of its history. It was the center of the whaling industry in the 19th century and in the center of the cotton textile industry after that, and now the biggest commercial fishing port in America, and we're ready to jump into this industry with both feet.
Now, is this enough to basically offset the setback that New Bedford had when Cape Wind canceled its 2-year lease for its terminal because they couldn't find financing?
By a factor of four. The new legislation that was passed last month provides for 1,600 megawatts of electricity to be purchased by utilities from offshore wind developers. The Cape Wind development would have been about 400 megawatts, maybe a little bit more. So what we're talking now are much larger projects that produce electricity much more efficiently in a much windier place. And so these projects won't have the impact on ratepayers that Cape Wind would have, and they will likely create far, far more jobs in New Bedford.
Mm. Well, let's move to fishing because, of course, New Bedford is one of the most important fishing ports in the United States. Now, you wrote a letter just last month to Christy Goldfuss, who's managing director at the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and you expressed concerns about a possible marine monument that the federal government is considering in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Massachusetts. What are your concerns?
Well, the concerns are largely procedural. We in New Bedford, the industry, and folks who, like me, who support the industry, are not categorically opposed to designating some area of the ocean floor that has a heightened scientific value in perpetuity. That's the idea behind the monument designation, and we don't object to that per se. What we do object to is the procedure that has been used to figure out where that should be. So the monument designation is proceeding under the Antiquities Act, which was originally passed 100 years or so ago by Congress to give the president some fairly wide authority to designate areas of the West as off limits for farming and for ranching. And it's worked pretty well there. But then it's been used in the last 20 years or so to designate areas of the ocean. That gets a lot more complicated, and particularly in places that are intensely fished over time, such as the North Atlantic. So we've had very cordial discussions with the White House, and as a Democrat, I'm a big supporter of President Obama, but the process has lacked the kind of rigor that I think is appropriate and necessary under the circumstances.
Well, Mayor Mitchell, just for clarity's sake, I mean, I understand your procedural concerns and wanting all stakeholders to be part of this process, but is one of the primary concerns amongst New Bedford fishermen that if this marine monument gets created, as you said, they could lose access to it as fishermen in perpetuity?
Well, they could. It depends on where it is, of course, and therein lies the problem with the process. It's unclear where exactly the White House is thinking of putting this. We haven't seen a map. We haven't seen, well, let's a circle that says we propose this area. What do you think about it? That hasn't happened yet, and of course, there's at this point less than 4 months to go in the Obama administration, so time is running out for the serious kind of review that ought to be applied. So yes, the primary concern is both they'll get it wrong, they'll designate the wrong area, and the other problem is that it'll set a difficult precedent that in years ahead, future presidents might say, well, it was done before, let's do it again, let's do this area that looks like a good spot, and set the industry back further and have other unintended consequences potentially. I mean, these are permanent decisions that ought to be subjected to very close review,
right.
and that hasn't happened.
You know, Mayor Mitchell, we wanted to ask you about this marine monument or the proposed marine monument specifically because last month we had a conversation with the president and CEO of the New England Aquarium, Nigella Hilgarth. She and the aquarium are advocating for the creation of this marine monument, and she told us that these are her words, that at the moment there are no protected areas off the coast of New England, and this proposal is less than 1% of the total area of New England. And I wanted to ask you about it because you had been quoted in the Boston Globe saying that, you know, you love the aquarium, you support the aquarium, but you think in this case they've picked the wrong fight.
Well, so let me say a couple of things. So I do love the aquarium. Let me be clear about that. The aquarium is and their leadership are entitled to, you know, their opinion. I might feel more strongly about what those opinions are, say, if I were a board member of the aquarium, and the risk that the aquarium might be wading into a charged political issue. She's right. There are no marine monuments off of the east coast of the United States. This would be the first one. Again, the question is, will it be in an area where we're protecting something of high scientific value in perpetuity and also a place where fishing is largely not occurring? And to get to that point, to get to that right answer, requires an awful lot of input, and that just hasn't happened mm-hmm. yet.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions about some of the ballot measures that voters across the state are going to be looking at in November. What is your view about the proposal to lift the cap on charter schools in Massachusetts?
Well, I don't oppose charter schools categorically. I think they are, you know, can be good laboratories for new pedagogical techniques, for, you know, for exploring new curriculum. I think that they have longer school days and more school-based autonomy are all good things. We have a couple of very successful charter schools in New Bedford, but I think folks need to know that the expansion of charter schools has its limits, and the limits are primarily the ability for municipalities to fund them. And so I think governance by ballot question is fraught with peril, and we've seen it time and time again. And this is one of those really complex policy questions that ought to be settled through the legislative process and with ample input and deliberation, as opposed to just putting it simply on a ballot and having people say thumbs up or thumbs down. It's going to cause a real backlash among municipalities if it's passed. It's going to be, if it's not passed, there'll be a big backlash among charter school proponents. And I think it needs to be settled in a different way.
Interesting. But I mean, this thing is on the ballot for November. So are you going to vote against it?
Oh, I'm going to vote against it. New Bedford and many other communities can't afford it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to dodge your question. I'm just trying to frame it a little bit. No, we can't afford it. I mean, that's not just – and I think people need to know that vote – that you can be for charter schools and vote against this proposal. It just defies the ability – of municipalities to fund it.
Okay. And what about the question to legalize marijuana in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, I'm kind of an easy mark on that. As a former federal prosecutor, I think people would pick me as somebody who would be against it, and they would be right. I think, you know, at a time now where we are battling, we in New Bedford and many other communities across the Northeast are battling against the tide of addiction, the last thing we should be doing is throwing open the doors to yet more drugs that these days are becoming, in the case of marijuana, becoming far more powerful than what had been on the streets even 20 years ago. So that, too, is another policy question put on the ballot that is, again, fraught with peril, and I hope that gets voted down as well.
Well, finally, Mayor Mitchell, there's a couple quotes that we read you'd given South Coast Today, which I have to say I really love, and I just wanted to check in with you on those. One is that the paper said that you believe that the South Coast's reputation stems from New Bedford's success and that you've set out to do nothing less audacious than to improve the image of both. And you were also quoted as saying that, quote, patience isn't your strong suit, but residents deserve someone to go to bat for them. So I was wondering what you've been hearing from your constituents so far about the direction New Bedford's going in and how you're doing.
Well, I mean, if you were interviewing my children right now, they would agree wholeheartedly that patience is not my strong suit. As far as the direction of the city, look, I mean, I think history will judge it. I've been in office for 4.5 years after having served as a career federal prosecutor in both Boston and in Washington. And, you know, I've been blessed by being surrounded by a very talented team of folks. And we all know that New Bedford has some real strong cards to play. And we're in the business right now of rebuilding a city. It's not just recovering. We're building. And so, you know, the objective measures are very encouraging. New Bedford now has the lowest unemployment rate, has its lowest unemployment rate in some 15 years. Same with the dropout rate in our schools, the lowest in 15 years. Test scores are up. The city has its highest bond rating in its history now. It's not easy, but we are attracting investment. We are on the move. We are leveraging our assets, our port, our beautiful downtown, our history, our beaches. I mean, so many things. We have a lot of things going for us. And I think the over time, folks have lamented that New Bedford has such potential. You hear that from both folks in the city and beyond. New Bedford has such potential, and we're going about the business of realizing it.
Well, John Mitchell is the mayor of the city of New Bedford. Mayor Mitchell, it's been really great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
This Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. We all remember that morning. Cool air and a stunning blue sky as American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175 both departed Logan Airport. At 8:46 and 9:03 a.m., hijackers crashed both airplanes into the World Trade Center towers in New York. Almost 3,000 people were killed in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania that day. More than 200 had ties to Massachusetts. So this week, we're going to remember several of those people by visiting the places in Massachusetts that were most important to them and their loved ones. Today, we first go to Pocasset, a place of deep meaning for the widow of Dedham native Jeffrey Coombs.
I'm Christy Coombs. I was married to Jeff, who was a passenger on Flight 11. The Cape is a place that was very special to Jeff. You know, he grew up there with his family, going there for summer vacations. It was someplace that he was really excited to show me the first time he brought me out to Massachusetts. The place was called Pocasset, Mass., and they were in Patchouset, which is a small portion of Pocasset. And we basically brought our kids up there in the summertime. We would spend every weekend there. There were two beaches down there. One was the big beach and the little beach. We spent most of our time at the little beach, sitting there looking out into the channel and watching the big boats go by and wondering if we would ever be owners of one of them. It's at the end of a little path And you walk down this path toward the beach, and there's all kinds of seagrass and like a little inlet behind where the water sometimes comes up that high. Jeff used to go back there with the kids, and there's a floating boardwalk that they would walk on to collect crabs and see the little fish and things like that. We just go down and kind of an escape. His brothers found this nice little spot to put the rock. That's what we call it, Jeff's Rock, at Jeff's Beach. And so it's just a nice place. We don't have a grave site for him. So it's a nice place to go and just kind of touch his name and wish he was there with us.
That was Christy Coombs talking about one of her husband Jeffrey Coombs' favorite places, Pocasset. We're remembering Massachusetts victims of the 9/11 attacks by visiting places filled with memories for their loved ones. Newton native Amy Toyin was in New York at the Windows of the World at the World Trade Center. She was on the 106th floor on 9/11. Her former fiancé took us to the Federal Street bus stop in Boston's Financial District.
My name is Jeffrey Gonski, and I live in Natick, Mass. So in September 2011, I was 26 years old. Amy was 24. We had just gotten engaged in Ireland, and we're starting to look into buying a house and planning weddings. Part of Amy's job was working, giving demonstrations and coordinating a marketing program for her financial products through Thompson Financial. And on that day, there was a trade show at Windows on the World of the top floor of the World Trade Center. I was working for Brown Brothers Harriman, and we were both living in the Newton Corner area. So typically after a long work day, generally we would coordinate time so we can meet at the Federal Street bus stop to take the same bus home together every night and sit next to each other. The Federal Street bus station is right in the heart of the financial district, right outside the Pregnant building. So I was able to shoot over right after work and just hang out for a little while. She would be coming from South Boston, so I was always keeping an eye out, watching the buses, watching the street to see when she was going to come. It was always the best part of my day. You know, no matter how bad the day might have been, it was always nice to see Amy because she would always greet you with a smile.
That's the sound of the Federal Street bus stop in Boston's Financial District with Jeffrey Gonski. Our series, Remembering 9/11 Victims, continues tomorrow from Lake Cochituate in Framingham. We first aired these audio postcards, produced by WBUR's Dan Mozzie, back in 2011. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Paralympics begin today in Rio, and seven Massachusetts athletes are there hoping for gold. Among them, 24-year-old Femita Iambeku. She's 24, as I said, and a single-leg amputee. She lost her leg 13 years ago. But until last November, Iambeku didn't even know how to run. Her love affair with running began through a chance meeting with another Paralympian, Jerome Singleton, and Sherman Hart, the former longtime track coach at Northeastern University. We met up with the three of them at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School in Dorchester as they were getting in some final training runs before Rio.
Running was just never an idea that I had.
Come on, fast, drive, come on.
My name is Femita Iambeku. I'm from Randolph, Massachusetts, and I will be competing in the 100 meters and the 200 meters at the Paralympic Games. 13 years ago now, I was 11, I was in a car accident. me and my older sister, Wendy, were ejected out of the car on the highway. My leg was cutting off the circulation to the rest of my body, so they had to amputate immediately. So I'm a right leg below the knee amputee, so I have my knee cap and my calf, and then I don't have everything else under. And now I am the national champion for the women's 100 T44. I've only been doing this, you know, for a very short period of time. Last November of 2015, I had my leg donated to me from OSER at the Running and Mobility Clinic in Boston. OSER is a prosthetist company. They make the Cheetah, the Flex Run. So I put the leg on, and they had me in the beginners group. And I put it on, and I'm like, are you guys sure I'm supposed to be in this group? Because I feel like I can just run, you know? I don't remember what it's like to have 2 feet anymore, because it's been such a long time. But if I knew what 2 feet felt like, I would imagine this is what it would feel like. I just feel like I'm floating. It's like, I don't know, I just feel so free, you know? I just run, and I don't have to think about it. Running feels so much more natural to me.
When I saw her, she looked, you know, pretty athletic. My name is Jerome Singleton Jr. And I'm a Paralympic and world champion in the T44 for below knee amputees.
I'm like, where can I run? Like, is there like an amputee running group in Boston? Like, where can I go? What can I do? And he told me that he trains at the Reggie Lewis Center. So I went down there, and that's where I met Sherman.
Come on, drive, 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 drive.
My name is Sherman Hart. I am Fermita's coach. I'm also a track coach who has been coaching for years.
He said that he would coach me if I wanted to, and I'm like, coach me for what? So I'm like, okay, whatever. If you'll teach me how to run, then that's fine. I'll train with you. So,
and you know, I figured, okay, Fermita has been an athlete before, so I'm good. You know, it's okay. You know, it's real easy. You know, and then she came and said, no, I've never been an athlete before. I said, oh, okay. First week was really shaky. The first couple of days were out there for me. I had to question Sherman, are you really ready for this? Do you really want to get into this? Probably a week and a half, she ran a little faster. I said, oh, wow, she's got a little giddy up, so we're going to get this going here. So
I just became very dedicated to it because they were willing to put in their time with me, so I didn't want to waste their time either. So I started coming 4 days a week faithfully.
They're doing the same workouts as all the rest of my athletes. Matter of fact, you know, I coach some elite college athletes. They work out with them, so, and they do the same workout.
Coach Hart entered me in some local races over the summer, and when I first started, I think I was expecting more out of myself than I realized. You know, you're not supposed to be, you can't be number one just starting, even though I am, but that's not how it was supposed to work, you know.
And when you get out there and you're with those coaches out there, don't worry about it, just do what you're doing. Okay.
So when I compete with able bodies, I'm like, I'm just like you guys. I should be able to be just as fast, come out just as hard, and do everything just as good as them. And I didn't realize how good I was because all the meets we were going to, I was getting in like third, and I'm thinking I'm supposed to be winning. I think I'm supposed to get in first place. And I'm like, oh, I suck. I'm not getting first place. They were like, no, you're doing pretty good.
We don't really even talk about winning or losing. We just talk about executing. So I told her I do have one favorite color. So I had to tell her that, though. I do have one favorite color, so, you know. I think if she goes and executes, I think she has a great chance of winning. She just has that kind of mentality.
When I was competing in the beginning of the summer with the able bodies, I felt like I was trying to prove something. Opposed to now competing against other amputees, it's more fun for me now. We're all going through the same struggles, and we're all here to do the same thing. You know, we just want to run. We all just want to see how fast we can go, you know, and I just want to run fast. So, you know, whatever time anybody else is running, I just want to know that I ran the best race that I can run, you know.
I think Olympics is a representation of God's given talent, like the talent you've been given and how far you can take it. When I look at Paralympics, it's still God-given talent, but it also shows the desire of the human will.
Which is why I think the Paralympics is such a beautiful thing, because it shows people that, you know, we don't have legs, we don't have arms, but we can still do everything, you know. I'm driven just to show the world, you know, it's just a beautiful thing.
Paralympians Fermita Iyembekwu and Jerome Singleton, along with their coach, Sherman Hart. Fermita will be running in the women's 100-meter and 200-meter sprints. Jerome will be competing in the men's 100, the long jump, and the 4x100-meter relay. next week, and best of luck to both of them. Our visit was produced by Radio Boston's Kathleen McNerney and Tim Skog. And since it is Wednesday, it's time to bring in Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna. And wasn't that an exceptional story?
I love that. That's they're
fantastic.
Absolutely right. It's
I
a beautiful thing.
I love the laugh. I'd listen to it all day long.
In fact, it's stories like that that make me lament the fact that the Paralympics don't get as much attention as they do and deserve, or as they should or deserve to. I mean, they kick off today in Brazil. Is Brazil ready to host the Paralympics?
Well, up until very recently, I would have said that's a real good question. There was talk about closing some of the venues. They were running out of money. The ticket sales were terrible. And then, as frequently happens with Olympics and with Paralympics as well, there's some sort of burst toward the last moment. And so there have been an increase in ticket sales. And I heard one report that said the village where the Paralympians are staying is top-notch, and they're very happy.
Good.
I think that the dire predictions are perhaps somewhat over-exaggerated.
Well, that's good to know. And apparently a last-minute bailout for the Brazilian government.
Yeah, a lot of people probably will be seeing those games on free tickets. But that's not so strange. When my wife and I went to the Olympics in 2012 in London, we sat next to several people who were in the armed services in the U.S., and they had tickets that they'd been given by people who said, hey, we think, you know, we are grateful for your service. Here's tickets to the Olympics. And so on their leave, they were sitting watching the quarterfinals of men's basketball at the Olympics.
Not too shabby.
Right.
All right. Well, let's move on to football. Apparently, Tom Brady's face is on the lighthouse at Gillette Stadium. Four-game suspension, Deflategate, blah, 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 blah. There's actually another football story that you brought to our attention that I really want to talk about. Two mothers of deceased former youth football players, Pop Warner players, they filed a lawsuit in California that also names USA Football, the NFL's Youth Development Program, and the National Operating Committee on Standards for Athletic Equipment, all because they say their children died posthumously they discovered that these young people had CTE.
Same thing that they found in the overwhelming majority of the brains of former NFL players that have been examined posthumously. This is quite a story, and I'm not sure exactly where it's going, of course. The lawsuit may end up being a class action suit, and of course that depends on the judgment of judges, and it depends on how many other parents of former youth football players decide that they want to have their names associated with this lawsuit. If it does end up being a class action lawsuit, it's hard for me to imagine how youth football, as it's presently constituted, could continue.
Yeah.
But they have, Pop Warner and other youth football leagues have settled individual lawsuits in the past successfully, just as the NFL did before that became a class action suit. We're going to have to keep an eye on this, see how it develops.
So the question of concussions, I mean, we did a story a couple years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, after five young players in a Pop Warner game in central Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. In one game, five of them had concussions and got knocked out. So there was a lot of concern about equipment and about how much young kids were being pushed to play through the pain and that kind of thing. But I don't think I've seen or heard of young people having CTE until this case.
Right. And I think the thing that distinguishes this case is the two men whose brains have been examined were only 24 and 25. They had not played a lot of football after Pop Warner. These were not guys who played D1 college football,
right,
and then went into the NFL. I think one of them quit after his freshman year in high school. So there may very well be a case for the damage having been done when they were quite young.
Yeah.
And if that is, in fact, the case, as I say, it may very well change the face of youth football.
Well, this is a story we'll definitely be keeping our eyes on and following up with at Radio Boston and Only a Game, I'm sure. In the last couple of minutes that we have, Bill, let's move on. We didn't actually talk about this last week, so let's make up for that error and talk about tennis, because the U.S. Open women's and men's semifinals are underway tomorrow and Friday. Any surprises?
Well, I guess it's always a surprise when Rafael Nadal doesn't make it into at least the semifinals.
Good point.
But I think all eyes are on Serena Williams. If she does manage to win this tournament, and everybody from whom I've heard has said that she's playing brilliantly right now, she would become the most accomplished female tennis player in history in terms of number of major tournaments won. And it's fun, isn't it, to be able to say, I was there to see the best, the most accomplished. It's the way people talk about having seen Ted Williams hit in the major leagues or, you know, seeing whoever seems to be the best.
She's going for 23. This would be number 23.
And this would be the record breaker. That's right.
Wow.
And it's quite extraordinary. And for the most part, you know, has done it with really quite exceptional grace. So it's been fun to watch, and I'm rooting for her.
Well, let's close out today by talking about the Red Sox for a bit. They're back in first place in the AL East, tied with Toronto.
Tied anyway, yes.
Okay, tied with Toronto. So how's the team looking, even though their pitching may still not be so
great? I think they look great in this division. That's the problem. I mean, you look at some of the other divisions and the leads that the really good clubs in Major League Baseball have established. The Cubs are 15 and a half games ahead.
Yeah.
They're in first place. The fact that the Red Sox haven't been able to put any distance between themselves and a couple of other teams is a little discouraging, and most of the people who are smarter than I am about baseball say the Blue Jays are the likely winner in this division. Hey, they're hanging around, and it's September.
Not too bad.
You got to be optimistic.
Bill Littlefield's the host of NPR's Only a Game. You hear it on Saturdays on WBR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Good to have you, Bill.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Beatam Theresiam de Calcutta, Santam esse discernimus et definimus.
This past Sunday at the Vatican, Pope Francis formally delivered the formula for canonization of Mother Teresa, just 19 years after her death. The crowd broke out in applause even before Francis declared Blessed Teresa of Calcutta to be a saint.
Inter santos pia devotioni recole de vere, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
Amen.
She bowed down before those who were spent, left to die on the side of the road, seeing in them their God-given dignity, Francis said. Quote, she made her voice heard before the powers of this world so that they might recognize their guilt for the crime of poverty they created. Well, Mary Johnson is one of many who know the force of Teresa's spiritual charisma firsthand.
The eyes of this woman on the cover just kind of drew me in, and the bell was ringing for my French class. I didn't pay any attention. I just walked right into the library, took the magazine off the shelf, and started reading about Mother Teresa.
Johnson was just 17 years old at the time, a high school student, entranced by a picture of Mother Teresa on the cover of Time magazine.
And as I read the article about how Mother Teresa was taking the poor off the streets of Calcutta, finding babies in dustbins, taking people who were dying and caring for them, somehow I just kind of knew that's what I had to do.
2 years later, at the age of 19, Mary Johnson became a nun in Mother Teresa's order. She spent 20 years in the Missionaries of Charity, but Johnson says it was a challenging and complicated experience for her. Ultimately, she left the order, got married, and wrote a book about her time with Teresa. It's called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. We spoke with Mary Johnson back in 2011, as the Vatican was in the midst of the sainthood process for Mother Teresa. And Johnson began our conversation by describing her first assignment as a nun in the Missionaries of Charity, a convent in the South Bronx.
The idea was to live like the poor that we were serving. And so the chapel was a room pretty bare. We knelt on carpets on the floor. We didn't have any seats. And the dormitories were just big rooms with beds inside. That was the only thing inside the dormitory. There weren't any divisions between the beds. We just had beds, no night table, nothing. There was a shelf outside in the hall where you'd keep your clothes. We just lived a really very poor, very simple life.
I get the sense that even from that first day, it was apparent to you that Mother Teresa's teachings, her way of living, informed every single aspect of life
Everything. You're right. From the time we got up at 4:40 in the morning until we went to bed at 10 o'clock at night, every minute of the day was scheduled. We had four and a half hours of prayer every day. We had more than 8 hours of work with the poor. We would have 1 hour of free time once a week, and sometimes we didn't even quite manage that. It was a life of total devotion that way, that every minute was consecrated to the service of God and to the poor. The way we did things.
Did you feel that, though, in when you were in the South Bronx, that your actions were in service to the poor, or did you feel that they were in service to Mother Teresa's ideal form of living?
We always had to do things the Missionary of Charity way. Mother Teresa told us when we joined, she said, stay and be faithful for life or pack your bags and go home right now.
I wonder if we can explore a little bit further your journey towards living this life, because there's a wonderful section in the book where you describe how it's late at night, well, after 9 o'clock, and after 9 o'clock, the sisters didn't speak.
That's correct. After night prayer, we had a period of grand silence until the next morning after breakfast.
And there's a memory that you recall when you were taking a shower.
Yes. So that particular night, I went into the bathing room. We didn't use electricity after night prayer either, so no speaking and no electricity. We had these little candles that were kind of leftover stubs from the altar that we would use so that we could see at night. The candle was burning in the corner, and I had my shower. The water was cold, and I couldn't even open the door all the way because my aspirant mistress was standing right there in the doorway, and she was obviously very angry, and she looked at me and she spoke, which was already something very significant because it was after night prayer. We weren't supposed to speak. And she said, you took a shower. You're not supposed to take a shower. What are you doing? And she had a whole slew of adjectives for me. I think she called me vain, lazy, immodest, all these things. And I was completely baffled why on earth she was, you know, so upset and why she was saying this. And I came out. And the next morning, I found one of the other sisters, and she explained to me that we were supposed to take a bath at night, just filling up our bucket with water and pouring the water over our heads with the little tin can that was there in the bathroom.
So your infraction was that you actually just used the shower filling up a bucket.
Exactly.
Now, the next morning afterwards, when you asked another sister, why was it that you were so severely reprimanded for having used the shower head, you write that you reached out and squeezed her hand to say thank you.
I did, and that was really against the rules. We weren't supposed to touch anyone, especially not the sisters. We could touch someone, for example, in service to the poor, if we had to give someone a bath, if we had to, whatever. But Mother Teresa used to tell us that even if we were taking care of the babies, not to hold them any longer than was necessary, and never to touch a sister. And I think that was...
What was the reasoning for that, though? Why did she say that?
It was an extreme way that Mother Teresa understood the vow of chastity. She used to tell us, we are only always all for Jesus. And she used to extend that to the fact that we wouldn't touch each other, that we wouldn't have special friends among the sisters. We were supposed to treat everybody the same. We were never supposed to get too close to anybody. We were never supposed to act on any sort of, you know, just natural, oh, I'd like to get to know that person a little better. I'd like to be friends. I'd like to get close. And eventually that also became really hard for me.
In those first 6 months, you actually met Mother Teresa.
I did, yes.
She came to the South Bronx.
She came to the South Bronx. She was there for about 10 days, and it was just a wonderful thing. I remember how she came in the door at the South Bronx, went straight into the chapel, was so focused, and then came out and came into the refectory and had dinner with us, and I had cooked that day, and I was just watching to see, will she like my soup? And just to see her talking and sharing like anybody else, it was nice.
So after your time in the South Bronx, you actually did go to Rome. And this was a part of the book which I just found to be astounding, because one thing in particular was you spoke with a woman named Sister Alberta, and through her you learn about something called the discipline.
Yes. So the sisters had a small rope whip with which they would beat themselves every night. The idea was that we were to share the sufferings of Jesus, and that would be a way also of sharing the sufferings of the poor and of making up for our sins and the sins of the world. Mother Teresa told us repeatedly, she would say, the discipline is optional. But optional means we choose to do it.
It used a rope?
Basically, the way to describe it, I think, is a whip that was made of rope. It had, we'd make them ourselves. There's a kind of a handle, and then 5 extensions with knots on them. So it was a significant amount of pain. It wasn't anything that drew blood. It was, you know, just, yeah.
Did you do it?
I did it. I did it.
When? Do you remember how old you were?
How old was I? I would have been 20 then. Yeah, I would have been 20. And then it continued that for 20 years, basically.
Every night?
Every night. There were a few exceptions, not on Sundays, not on special feast days, but basically every night.
Did you ever question the validity of Mother Teresa's logic in this? That to cause yourself pain brings you closer to understanding the sufferings of the poor?
For Mother Teresa, Jesus crucified was everything. As we came to know with the letters that were published 10 years after her death, she talks about this sense of being tortured in her soul. And eventually there was a priest who explained to her, Mother, this is not a sign that you're far from God. It's a sign you've come so close to God that you are sharing Jesus' suffering on the cross. And I think that's kind of what formed Mother Teresa's spirituality, this idea, okay, so any trouble that I'm having, the doubts that I'm having, these feelings of agony, this is what's bringing me closer to Jesus, it's bringing me closer to the poor. And it was an unusual spirituality to me. It wasn't the way I was used to things. And eventually, for me, the resurrection somehow was more important, to pass through that suffering and to live in the resurrection.
But it sounds like that is also, I mean, you left the Missionaries of Charity. And that is also one of your most impassioned criticisms, if I can say, of her, of Mother Teresa, that she stopped at the suffering, that she couldn't get past suffering to these other aspects of what service might be?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that it was important, obviously, to feed the poor. It was important to someone who is hungry, someone who is not well clothed, someone who has no place to sleep for the night, you can't expect that person to begin to support themselves. You have to help them to get to that place. And that was enough for her, but in the end, it wasn't enough for me.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about what was happening with you over the period of the 20 years that you were a sister in the Missionaries of Charity, because you write very frankly about the fact that you needed to seek comfort in other people. I mean, we spoke a little earlier about how one of the rules was no touching between the sisters, and yet you went farther than that. I mean, you write about relationships you had.
Yes, I do write about relationships. I think it's very important that people start, especially, you know, in the Catholic Church, to speak honestly about the need for human connection and what that means for people. But I did develop a relationship with one of the sisters that definitely crossed the lines, went far beyond the you shall not touch rule. You know, eventually I get close to a priest as well. And I really did need...
Just to be clear, these were physical, intimate relationships.
The one with the sister went farther than the one with the priest as far as the physical things go. But yes, there was that component. Definitely there was a physical attraction. Especially when you're living a life of service and of this total dedication, of where you really have no way to find comfort in anything but prayer and the company of your sisters. It can be a very lonely life, especially if you're not supposed to make friends. And eventually I realized that I needed a closer relationship with someone.
Now, you said something very interesting, that you feel like the Catholic Church needs to be more honest about what people need in terms of physical and emotional connection.
We have these vows of celibacy, these vows of chastity, but they're very often not kept. The studies that have been done show that at any given time, only about 50% of the priests who are vowed to celibacy are actually observing it. So why aren't we considering things like the married clergy when these needs are so obviously there? And if you just hide behind it, you're not willing to talk about it, but you're pursuing these relationships in secret, you're living a double life in so many ways. It's just not good for anybody.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you well know, Mother Teresa is going down the path towards official canonization by the Vatican, official sainthood. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that Mother Teresa wanted to be a saint. That was kind of very clear. She had always told us, she said, Mother made a promise. She used to speak of herself in the third person often. And she said, Mother made a promise to give saints to Mother Church. And she was talking that each one of us was meant to be a saint. I remember one day when we were in Rome, and Mother had been attending the Synod of Bishops as one of the only women invited to this meeting of bishops from throughout the world. And she came and she was having tea with us one day. And this was during the papacy of John Paul II. And she just stopped for a second and she said, you know, you all should hurry up and die. And we just kind of looked. Mother had never said anything like this before. And she said, yes, because the current pope is canonizing everybody. And it was really kind of, I think, at that moment that I realized, okay, so, because she wasn't just making a joke. It was really clear that there was part of her that really wanted to have a lot of missionaries of charity made canonized saints. And for me, that had never been a goal. To live a good, honest, loving life was important. To have that recognized in some sort of official way by the church really wasn't important for me.
Now, you spent, as you said, some 15-plus years in Rome.
Yes.
Out of your 20 or so years total in the Missionaries of Charity. Does that mean that you were never assigned to Calcutta, to India?
That's correct. I have still now never been to India.
You've never been there. For people, especially for sisters who have dedicated their life to this form of service, as described and lived by Mother Teresa, if it becomes impossible to understand why without seeing and experiencing firsthand the level of suffering, the abject poverty and sickness and disease in Calcutta, for example, that it just doesn't make sense if you're living in Rome, in the opulence of Rome. But maybe if you had gone to India and had had a chance to be there at the sort of the nadir of human experience, maybe this brand of sacrifice would have made sense and you would have been able to stick with it.
It wasn't the physical hardships that were a reason that I left. In the beginning, it was the thing I noticed first because everything was so different. But it was the emotional deprivation, the not having the relationships, the never being able to come forward with your own ideas and to approach your work in a creative way. Those were the things that ultimately became so difficult that I began to feel as though I were suffocating. That ultimately proved far more difficult than the life of poverty.
Since then, you've gotten married.
Yeah.
You live in Nashua. Do you still consider yourself a Catholic?
I don't. No.
Do you consider yourself religious?
I don't consider myself a religious person.
Do you believe in God?
Not in the way that most people would conceive of God, certainly not in the way that I did before. You know, there are a lot of mysteries in the world, a lot of things we don't understand, and we have these experiences sometimes of something larger than ourselves. These things happen, but we don't really know why. We cover that up a lot of times with this word God, and I think for me right now that's kind of the way that I can live honestly in this world, just kind of looking at the moment, not trying to add on any sort of explanation, interpretation, extra sort of story to go with my life, and just to live still out of a heart of love and of connection without the religion.
Mary Johnson is author of An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. Johnson spent 20 years as a nun in the Missionaries of Charity. We spoke with her in 2011. This past Sunday, Pope Francis formally canonized Mother Teresa. She is now Saint Teresa of Calcutta. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.